This is Michael Matheson Miller, and you are listening to the Moral Imagination Podcast. Thank you for listening to the Moral Imagination Podcast. My guest today is Professor William Easterly. I'll get to his bio in a moment. A bit before I do, I want to thank all of those who've written a review on Apple Podcasts. If you do like the podcast and you have some time, please give it a 5-star review. It does help grow the podcast. Also, thanks to those who've supported me on Patreon. I do very much appreciate the support. It means a lot. And you can subscribe at themoralimagination.com, where I send out not only updates on podcasts, but essays I've written and various other pieces of information. Speaking of which, Acton University this summer, the 4-day conference we have, is open for applications. So you can apply to that as well. That's a great conference. I've spoken there every year since the beginning. And we have about 900 people or so from 70, 80 countries come in. It's a really, really interesting conference. So if you're interested in that, that's Acton University. That's this June. So again, acton.org, you can find all that information. And so my guest today is Professor William Easterly. I'm very delighted and honored to have Professor Easterly on the show. He is a professor of economics at New York University and the co-director of the NYU Development Research Institute, which won the 2009 BBVA Frontiers of Knowledge in Development Cooperation Award. He is the author of 3 books, The Tyranny of Experts, Economists, Dictators, and the Forgotten Rights of the Poor. Secondly, The White Man's Burden, Why the West Efforts to Aid the Rest Have Done So Much Ill and So Little Good. And that won the F.A. Hayek Award from the Manhattan Institute. And finally, The Elusive Quest for Growth, Economist Adventures and Misadventures in the Tropics. He has published more than 60 peer-reviewed academic articles, has written columns and reviews for the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Financial Times, New York Review of Books, Washington Post, and more. He has served as the co-editor of the Journal of Development Economics and the director of the blog AidWatch. He is a research associate of NBER. A senior fellow at BREAD, Foreign Policy Magazine, named him among the top 100 global public intellectuals in 2008 and 2009. And Thomson Reuters listed him as one of the highly cited researchers of 2014. And he is very proud to say he is the 11th most famous native of Bowling Green, Ohio. So I'm very delighted to have Professor Easterly on the podcast. Bill, thank you so much for joining the Moral Imagination.
Thanks, Michael. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's good. Well, I'm very happy to have you on the podcast. We've tried to do this for a while. So your work, I think, is just very, very important. When we first met, I told you about this, but I remember when I was in graduate school and I was studying development economics and I was thinking, well, everything seems so hardcore social engineering, and I was skeptical of foreign aid, and I only saw P.T. Bauer, right? You hadn't written, your books hadn't come out yet. And when your book, Elusive Quest for Growth and The White Man's Burden and Tyranny of Experts came out, I was like, oh, this stuff is great. So it's like, so I'm very happy to have you on the podcast, and you're really an expert in this. So I'm delighted.
Oh, thank you. You're excessively kind.
So let's begin. Why don't we begin in the big picture? So we'll talk about your books on development, and then you have a brand new book that you're working on, which we'll talk about as well. But why don't we maybe go into a big picture theme of your work? I mean, you've been working in the realm of what's called development economics for decades, and you worked for the World Bank. You've done all these different things. You're a professor at NYU, and you're kind of an iconoclast. You're a little bit of a critic. Could you talk about maybe some of your journey of your both intellectual and also your work journey of what made you get to this position to be a critic of the dominant model of economic development?
Yeah, so from 1985 to 2001, I was at the World Bank. I was actually pretty happy at the World Bank. It was a very nice job to have. I was in the research department, which is probably one of the world's cushiest jobs for an economist, for a development economist. You know, lots of nice travel and great intellectual stimulation from my colleagues. But I was also exposed to what was going on in the operations side of the bank and kind of gradually becoming more and more troubled by how poorly it seemed to be working, what the World Bank was doing as far as lending and giving advice to poor countries.
And so what were the things that kind of troubled you?
You know, I think I saw several things that were troubling. One is the amount of aid that was given was sort of unrelated to the affect the conditions for that aid to be effective. So aid was given to countries that were, you know, really mismanaged economically. There was a lot of corruption and autocracy and severe economic distortions, like severe restrictions on trade, very high inflation, lots of black markets, lots of price controls. I mean, my first country I went to upon joining the World Bank was Ghana in 1985. And Ghana was just a disaster at that point due to all of these factors that I just basically kind of checked all of those boxes that I just listed. I had actually lived in Ghana, you know, in 1969-70 when I was 12 years old, because my father had taught for a year as a professor in Ghana. And when I first went to Ghana, I was shocked by how badly it was doing compared to what I remembered, you know, from as a 12-year-old. And that was really sort of the bankruptcy of the traditional development model, the development model based on, you know, heavy state planning, heavy state intervention, a lot of expertise of local and foreign development economists that led to that kind of catastrophe. By the early 1980s, Ghana had killed off its leading export, which was cocoa. There was a famine in Ghana in the early 1980s. So to give some credit to the World Bank, you know, the World Bank did give some decent advice at that time, and Ghana started to do economic reforms that started to lead to an economic recovery. But elsewhere, so Ghana actually turned out to be one of the happier cases, but elsewhere, I saw countries that were just, you know, stuck in the poverty, and the World Bank was just giving the same old aid programs over and over again, even when countries were not doing economic reforms. So Zambia was another country that I was often commenting on as a researcher. World Bank, the operations department, always invited the research department people to comment on their operations. What I saw is Zambia was getting one structural adjustment loan after another, you know, with each one promising to do major economic reforms that would fix the economy and fix the economic mismanagement, fix the price controls and the inflation and the debt and the budget deficits and all that. But then nothing happened. There was none of these reform promises were kept. And yet the aid just kept flowing in. You know, that one was a disaster. And unfortunately, there are more Zambias than there were Ghanas, where there were just economic disasters caused by really misguided development ideas. And the World Bank, you know, it had some good economic thinking, but it didn't seem to have a way of translating those into aid. You know, somehow it always in the end wanted to give aid no matter what, like push the aid out the door, even when the conditions were really unfavorable. And so as a result, you know, the Sub-Saharan Africa, for example, had received, you know, about $1 trillion in aid in constant dollars as of the time that I was thinking about this, and had negative per capita growth since independence. So clearly something was not working here. And so that's when I started working on a book that later I titled The Elusive Quest for Growth. It was just sort of a point-by-point documentation of how the standard advice was just not working in development.
Yeah, I remember actually when Ghana, by the way, my parents actually lived in Ghana. So.
Oh, wow. Wow. Yeah. We have a Ghana connection.
Yeah, like Ghana, actually. It's great.
I have a lot of colleagues now who were from Ghana.
Yeah, it's great. I remember, in fact, I think there was The Economist magazine saying, like, this Ghana was a model because it had moved from project aid to structural adjustment, where it was going to be like broad economic reforms. And that was a kind of like the big deal. But it's interesting because you point out, well, that Ghana was a happy success, maybe, but in some ways, relative to others, but most of the places it didn't work. This foreign aid,
yeah, right.
For listeners, like, so I'm obviously, as you know, critical of the foreign aid model, and the film I directed, Poverty Inc., is very much a critique of the poverty industry. That in fact, that despite good intentions, the model of like foreign aid has actually delayed the development of business. It ended up politicizing development. And a lot of the critiques that you say echo the work of Peter Bauer in like the 1980s, right? Because Peter Bauer was saying, look, aid is going to politicize development. You're giving, it's too much of GDP. It's too influential in the economy. And it's really not going to be as productive. And as you said, like after $1 trillion, you had negative per capita growth. For somebody who's listening who might maybe is surprised by that, say, wait a minute. I mean, how could foreign aid be bad for a poor country. What would be like a pretty, you know, at least a bullet point summary of why, despite good intentions, and it seems like it would work, does foreign aid actually create harm?
Yeah, so a lot of it has to do with where does aid actually go? So it almost always goes through the government of the recipient country, of the aid recipient country. So if that government, you know, and there's a reason a poor country is poor. It's, you know, not always, but usually it has a lot to do with government mismanagement of the economy, corruption, autocracy, you know, price controls, trade restrictions, destruction of property rights, expropriations, all those things. So when you put aid into that environment, then it's just, aid just becomes another thing that is subject to corruption, that is stolen. And that's, you know, P.T. Barr, who, by the way, it's no accident that there's an echo because I learned enormously from reading P.T. Barr. And P.T. Barr talked about the paradox of aid, which I think is a really good way of kind of summarizing the problem. And the paradox is the countries that need the aid will not be effective. And the countries and where aid will be effective don't need the aid.
Right.
Put it more bluntly, aid doesn't work where it's needed. Where aid works, it's not needed.
Right.
So you could give, aid would work well probably if you gave it to Switzerland, but Switzerland doesn't need aid. If you give aid to a poor country because it's poor, and of course you want to give aid to countries that are poor. Well, again, countries are poor for a reason, and the same reasons that led them to be poor are the same reasons that aid will be mismanaged.
Right. Yeah. In fact, I think maybe I said this, but like that, I remember finding like at a used bookstore in London, a book by P.T. Barr. I think it was Rhetoric or Reality, and then some other ones. And
yeah.
So he was the one person that I found who's like critical of foreign aid. Like you just couldn't, it was very interesting. He was an outlier. It was just very interesting. Everybody, yeah, like we read, yeah, like Michael Todaro's development economics book, and yeah, everything was just kind of top down social engineering, technocracy stuff, which we'll get into. And
yeah, here's a pariah in the development field.
Who's that? Sorry.
P.T. Barr was like a pariah. I mean, he was just criticized by almost everybody in the development field.
Yeah. And it was interesting. What I thought was great was in Angus Deaton's Great Escape, like his last chapter is essentially a vindication of P.T. Barr, which
very
was
much, yeah,
which
yeah,
was great to see.
Yeah.
So let's maybe go. We can go back into foreign aid, but that's, why don't you start? I think another example you give. You have your most recent book is The Tyranny of Experts. It's Economists, Dictators, and Forgotten Rights of the Poor. And to all listeners, I will put links to all these books. You should definitely read Professor Easterly's books. You actually start out with a powerful story. Could you tell that story, as it's somewhat of a emblematic of the way we've done development? And one of your critiques about development is not just that it's not like effective, but that it actually undermines political and human and property rights, et cetera. Can you talk about that? Because I think that's core to your argument. It's not so much like, I mean, yes, I think it's true. Like, well, it would be more efficient if we did X, Y, and Z. But beyond efficiency, there's actually much bigger things at stake.
Right. So I'm from Northwest Ohio. So in Northwest Ohio, there's a story where some farmers one Sunday morning were in church, and suddenly some soldiers arrived in the town and started burning down the homes of the farmers, started shooting the cattle, and marched the farmers at gunpoint away from their homes because the soldiers told the farmers, this land that you thought was yours is no longer yours. This land is being taken by a World Bank project. And the World Bank project is designed to alleviate poverty. It should be a good thing. So, you know, this land is no longer yours. It's now the property of the World Bank project. And so this sounds like a very strange story. You think, how could it possibly happen? Well, it did happen, but the one detail that I changed in the story is Northwest Ohio. It did not happen in Northwest Ohio. It happened in a district called Mubende in Uganda. So why the change of place makes so much of a difference? Well, we can't imagine that this would happen in Ohio because if it did happen, there'd be such an outcry that it would never happen again, because the residents of Ohio do have political and economic rights. They do have a court of appeal. They have a way to appeal to the political process, to, you know, their senator, their congressman, a district court judge, whatever. But the citizens of Mubende, Uganda, didn't have a court of appeal against the World Bank. This really was a World Bank project. It was a project by the World Bank's International Finance Corporation, which was doing a forestry project. So it's going to take these lands and turn them into a forestry plantation, which may actually have increased the economic value of the land. But that's of no comfort to the farmers who were dispossessed at gunpoint. This land had been in their families for several generations, and they had no recourse once this happened. This was documented in a series of articles by Human Rights Watch and other aid-watching organizations. And it actually appeared on the front page of the New York Times in 2011 when this happened. Even appearing on the front page of the New York Times, which is where I saw it, even after that, there was no outcry. Because it's sort of just taken for granted that people in Uganda don't have rights. And we don't really care enough, we meaning anyone else who influences the world of international development, doesn't seem to care enough to have those rights respected. So that's the thing that really bothers me the most about the aid business. It's not just the the material failures on poverty. It's the way that the poor are sort of radically deprived of equal political, economic, and property rights.
You know, this is something we talk about in Poverty Inc. And there's a certain, one of the ways I talk about this is that, and you can respond to this, is like humanitarianism, which is really a hollowed out, it's a kind of a secular version of Christian caritas, right? Of love. And the idea of love in the tradition is to seek the good of the other and then to like promote their flourishing and, you know, independent development, right? Success. And I think humanitarianism, it has the sort of a sentimental version of that. But what ends up doing is like to use kind of Nietzschean language of like, it has limited horizons. It stops at providing material comfort. And so it ends up turning poor people into objects of charity and pity that you need to socially engineer to solve. So I think there's like a fundamental underlying like philosophical or theological philosophical problem of how do we actually help people in poverty and what's the goal of it? I know you're critical of technocracy and everything. So first, how do you respond to that? Do you agree? Do you critique that? And then could you develop a little bit more? Because I know you work a lot. Your critiques are also on this sense of engineering poor people. Like, and that was part of your big debates with like Jeffrey Sachs and so many other of your debates.
Yeah, I mean, this is something I've got to care about more and more as I go, as I get older and less smart, but more wise, hopefully. I agree exactly with what you're saying. I think the problem is seeing people. I don't even want to say the words poor people, because that is already kind of a dehumanizing label. Seeing people as just sort of, beings that have needs, but no need for their own agency or consent or rights. No need for their own dignity. So you think that anything you do, you meaning the technocrat, the aid agency, whatever, anything you do that raises their material income, even if you're successful at doing that, if you've done that in a way that disrespects their own choices, their own right to consent, their own rights, then you've actually made them worse off, because if they did not consent to what you were doing, that's because they perceived they would be worse off by what you were doing. So if you're not accountable to them, if you have no way of consulting them on what they want, that's the situation in which you can wind up doing a lot of damage. So let me give in the new book you mentioned, I'm going a lot back into history and thinking of a lot of extreme historical examples. So let's start with the most extreme possible example, which is, slavery of the African diaspora in the New World. And let's just take the Southern United States as an example, or slavery in the British Empire. So defenders of slavery very often claim that the slaves had a higher material standard of living than some comparison group back in sub-Saharan Africa, where sometimes they even claim that slaves had a higher standard of living than the white working class in Britain or America. Now, obviously, they were very likely biased in these empirical claims, but there have been unbiased people who have admitted that that could have been correct. So Adam Smith thought it was probably true that slaves had higher material standards of living than either the African comparison group or the British working class. You know, a modern economic historian who got the Nobel Prize, Robert Fogel, argued in a book that the slaves in the southern United States before the Civil War had a higher standard of living than the white working class in the United States. So what does that tell us? Does that mean slavery is justified because there was a higher standard of living? Well, obviously not, because what's the crucial thing that's missing there is slaves did not consent to this deal where they would become slaves in return for a material standard of living. So, you know, we need to invoke consent to know whether someone is better off or not. That's the simple lesson of that very extreme example. Someone does not consent to a deal where they have a higher standard of living in return for something they don't want, in return for being coerced by someone else, which they don't want. Because people do have a demand for their own agency, their own freedom, their own rights, their own dignity, which are all radically denied by slavery, which are non-material needs. Those are the needs that have to be respected for someone to be better off. John Rawls, in a phrase that was much quoted by Amartya Sen, said that something to the, if I can paraphrase it, that self-respect, respect, and dignity are primary needs just as much as food and water. That being respected, to have the right to your own agency and dignity is just as much of a need as food and water. And that, I think, is the most radical failure of the aid business, is that failure to respect the agency of poor people.
Right. And, you know, I mean, obviously, I agree with you on that. I think this is, you know, a lot of my work is philosophy of the human person. And I think about this in terms of, like, how do we think about this? That a lot of our decisions downstream in economics and politics, development economics, come from a certain vision of the human person. And if we see the human person as simply a material thing where living standards is what matters, or material comforts what matters, then we make an error in who we're dealing with, because we're not dealing with objects that are to be socially engineered. We're dealing with subjects. And this really was the kind of the theme of the Poverty Inc. film, was that human beings are subjects to be respected, and they should be the protagonists of their own story of development. And that so much of economic development becomes this technical approach that ends up not respecting their agency.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. People have a right to consent to their own progress. What you think is progress for them, they have a right to decide for themselves whether that is progress. I think we can think of sort of the fundamental liberal values that should guide kind of the morality of aid, but seem to fail to guide, to be respected. The first dimension is consent versus coercion. And, you know, aid often embraces coercion in the form of just having no mechanism for consent, sometimes even having military interventions that are behind aid. The second is paternalism versus self-determination. And third is moral equality versus inequality. Do all peoples have the same right to consent? Do all peoples have the same right to self-determination? When you deny that on the basis of, you know, these people are too poor, they don't have, you know, we don't think their agency, their consent is a high priority with us. You know, we know what is best for them, and we're going to force them to take it. That's when you get into big trouble with aid.
I mean, I think that's the hubris of the technocrat, right? That
Correct.
People don't know what they want. They
Correct.
Don't know what's good for them.
Right.
That maybe leads into there's a couple of things I want to talk about, like a little bit of the history of development economics. But maybe before that, you have a chapter in Tyranny of Experts where you say a debate that didn't happen. And it's really, in many ways, what you just said with consent and paternalism and equality and decision-making is kind of, it all is boiled down in this debate that never happened between the two Nobel Prize winners, right? Gunnar Myrdal and Friedrich Hayek. I think it's that was a really interesting chapter of how you brought that out. And So maybe could you go through a little bit of that before? Because this, I think, was it underlies a lot of those areas of how we think about poor people. And one of them has to do with the knowledge problem. And do we know what poor people want? And how are we going to know what they want if they're not consent and participatory? Or another idea, which is, well, they don't really know what's good for them, so we're going to come in and solve their problems for them. And that's that paternalism. But it's actually even worse than paternalism, because it's not like a father. You know, Tocqueville has this great line in Democracy in America. He said, the state, it would be like a father, but it doesn't want you to grow up. Right. It's like,
that's a good line.
Yeah. It's a good line. And I think that's the paternalism. So it's even worse than paternalism. Like, I want my children to grow up and be independent persons. Right. And this isn't. So maybe could you go through that debate? Cause I thought that was a really good chapter. And I think also just very helpful to people to understand there are two, what you could call worldviews behind this vision. And yeah, you articulate it well.
Yeah, so Gunnar Myrdal is sort of the godfather of the idea of development planning, which was an extremely popular way of thinking about development from the beginnings of development in the 1940s and 50s, you know, well into the early 1980s. And, you know, central planning was where those words were used explicitly, and, you know, what kind of central planning was going on in the world at that time? Well, where was central planning happening? Well, of course, the Soviet Union. And kind of remarkably, as it seems might seem today, the Soviet Union was very much taken as a good model of development, how to do development. Because you couldn't just sort of let things happen as the Western countries had done. You had to sort of make things happen by the state sort of forcing people to save, forcing people to a very low level of consumption. So you have enough saving to invest, you know, a forced draft industrialization like was done in the five-year plans under Stalin. And then, you know, the high investment yields high economic growth, and then you get out of poverty with high economic growth. That was sort of the model. And then you know, the state also does central planning to decide where the scarce resources will go, where should things be invested. And, you know, it's a little extreme to say everyone wanted to emulate the Soviet Union. That's not quite true. But there was kind of a blindness to the dark side of the Soviet Union, which is more obvious to us today in retrospect. And so it was very much thought of as kind of the model of development, followed by, you know, like people like Walt Rostow, who was very influential in wrote the Stages of Economic Growth in the early 1960s under Kennedy administration. And then, you know, then on the other side, you have Friedrich Hayek, who made his name known by getting into a debate on central planning in the Soviet Union. And he pointed out, you know, no, the planner doesn't have enough knowledge to know where resources are going to be used, you know, viably. There's, you know, there's just a vast amount of knowledge you would need to have to know where, you know, something where some resources are going to be valuable. You know, you think that, maybe you think the central planner thinks that the wave of the future should be, you know, mainframe computers, but you know, someone else thinks it's going to be iPhones. And, you know, the planner has no way of getting that decision correct, because it just can't possibly have enough knowledge to get that correct. And then Hayek pointed out that the market sort of does that by economizing on knowledge, because in the market, you know, no investor has to have any piece of knowledge other than the rate of return of their own project. And as long as the rate of return of their financial rate of return of their own project is higher than, you know, the market interest rate or the world interest rate that you can earn on average on investments, then you go ahead with the project. And, you know, and any firm supplier supplying a good doesn't have to know anything except the market price of that good. And then the firm decides, you know, does the market price adequate to pay for my costs for me to supply that good to the market? And the consumer only needs to know the market price to decide, you know, do I want this good as opposed to some other goods? So the market sort of radically economizes on knowledge, and the market winds up at the iPhone while the planner was favoring mainframes computers. There was when I was first going to the last days of the Soviet Union and the early days of Russia in the early 1990s, there was a Soviet joke circulating that the Soviets were bragging that their factory made the world's largest laptops.
That's funny.
And, you know, that's kind of like Soviet self-knowledge about what was going wrong there.
Right, yeah.
So that was sort of Hayek's kind of central point, and that was essentially the point for which he won the Nobel Prize and sort of disproved the central planning. But then, you know, it becomes a much deeper point, which is basically that, you know, society as a whole is really what Hayek called a spontaneous order, which is a word that I love. And it's not, society was not planned by anyone. The economy, first of all, was not planned by anyone. Second of all, society as a whole was not planned by anyone. It just evolved. You know, social norms evolved, politics evolved, economies evolved with nobody in charge. And that was the same point Adam Smith had also made from the beginning, that, you know, no social engineer can design a perfect society. Perfect societies evolve to be better societies by observing certain norms and rules that themselves evolve to become popular, you know, and namely the liberal ideas, the liberal norms that evolved in countries that became rich, like the U.S. and the U.K. That's a very deep point that, you know, where development has happened, it hasn't happened because of technocratic experts. It hasn't happened because of central planning guided by wise development experts. Where it happened spontaneously, you know, where free people are operating in free markets.
No, I think it's a deep point too. I want to get to some of the contemporary critics of markets in a minute, but I've been thinking about this a lot. So I think there's a couple interesting points on the knowledge problem. You know, some people kind of push Hayek, oh, he's just this radical free marketer. He's not paying attention. But Hayek is actually thinking in much more layers of complexity because of what you just pointed out, like how all the things that are needed in order to make something happen, the amount of knowledge cannot be held in one person. So let me go, give me a boring example or a simple example, and then I want to go into a deeper problem and like to get your response. So the first thing I often think about is, you know, I'm blessed with no hair. Not everyone has the hair I have.
Yeah, I don't have a lot of hair either.
It's a blessing to be bald and dominant. But anyway, so if I walk into a store, the planner is going to think, well, he doesn't need a hairbrush. But right. I have 4 daughters, 3 sons, and a wife with hair. I have a lot of people who need hair. And people will always around my house ask, Dad, do you know where the hairbrush is? Which I think is slightly offensive. But I said, of course, it's the one thing I have no responsibility for. But the facts are, I need hairbrushes, right? So a planner could never know. I mean, it's a silly example. But the point is, there's all these needs or subjective values that Hayek, you know, addresses in the knowledge problem. And we're trying to do very complex things when it's, you can't even decide what's needed in my own household. I can't even decide, you know, in the New York University economics department, you don't have enough knowledge to plan everything, much less a major economy. And I think that somehow it's like this weird mind, like blind spot that somehow like, we know it's not possible, even in our own families, we have to delegate. And yet we think we could kind of engineer Ghana.
Right, right. Yeah, I think it's even worse than that, because not only do you not know what people want, but you're also, what often happens in development is you want to tell people what they should want. You think you know what they should want. So the development economists Esther Duflo and Abhijit Banerjee give an example in their book. I think it was in rural Morocco. This story that I'm going to tell appeared both in Poor Economics and later in a more recent book,
okay.
Good Economics for Hard Times.
Right, okay.
And so they met a man in Morocco who, you know, told them a story about how his family was so short of food. And, you know, they felt a lot of compassion for the shortage of food in this household. And they came into the house and they noticed there was a DVD player and a, you know, antenna for TV and a television. And they said, well, if you don't have enough food, why are you spending money on a television? And he laughed and he said, well, you know, my family wants this. You know, they want TV more than they want food. That was sort of an awakening for Duflo and Banerjee. Maybe not quite enough of an awakening in their case, who I respect a lot, but are not quite sympathetic enough to the need for free choice. That story kind of captures a lot of what development is about. So, you know, even more extreme, development economists are always complaining about how poor people have too many weddings and funerals. They spend too much on weddings and funerals. You know, they obviously, with their very low standard of living, they should save the money and spend it on food and health and education, all those things. Well, you know, all of us like to have family celebrations. All of us like the dignity of sending a loved one off with a nice funeral, or, you know, celebrating two young people with a nice wedding. You know, and people, it's called being a human being. You know, and so there's something very dehumanizing about telling someone, you know, you don't get to have a TV, you don't get to have a wedding, you don't get to have a funeral, because, you know, we think you need X, Y, and Z, you know, as the first priority. Something very dehumanizing about that. Obviously, there are problems of people who don't have enough to eat. And there are problems of people who might mismanage their own resources. But, and, you know, that the need for agency does not rest on the case that people always, you know, are super wisely rational, self-managing, managing their own lives in a super rational, effective way. You know, none of us can pass that test.
Right.
But the question is, you know, does someone else know better than you do what you need, what you want, what you should want? Or, you know, do you get to decide that for yourself? And that's kind of the radical need for moral equality, that everyone should have the right to decide for themselves what their own needs and wants are.
Well, I think it's a question of, like, we all need help. We all make errors, right? And we're all learning. And so, and I think this goes back into this point of consent and participation as well, right? So if I need financial advice and someone gives it to me, I can benefit from that advice, but I'm participating it. I have to be the protagonist. And I think what we see, and you could comment on this better than I from all your experience, but what we see is a lot of times development experts will come up with even the project that the town needs, but because it's not done in a participatory way, they establish the project and then it ends up failing because there wasn't a sense of even how the project could be done in a better way. I mean, you see just example of example after this.
Right.
But I think it's just, again, and I think it goes back to this one point, which is that's not how we would want to be helped. And that's what I think is the strange set. Like, why? I wouldn't want to be treated that way. I mean, it's like the golden rule. Like, why am I treating other people as if they don't have agency or intelligence? And I think this goes back again to something I talk about a lot, is that the difference, that is the poverty or ethnicity, race of the person, covers the identity. That is, we're both human beings.
Yeah.
You know, what Martin Buber calls I and thou, we're in an I-thou relationship. What happens is it becomes I versus thing that I need to manipulate. And I don't think it's necessarily intentional, but I do think it is the dominant model of development.
Yeah, I mean, I think reciprocity is a good test of moral equality. But I want to be in the same situation that I'm putting someone else in. You know, would I want to be helped by this paternalistic expert who says they know better than I do what's good for me? And I would say definitely not. So, you know, you mentioned the sort of aid experts who don't really comprehend what the needs and wants are. So let me give you another example. In my field, in the aid field, you deal with a lot of NGOs, and there's always a lot of new NGO startups, which are, you know, really well-intentioned people coming up with what often seems like a really good new idea to help a lot of poor people at once. And so a couple of examples of that kind of mindset and how it could possibly go wrong. One is someone a few years ago decided that a really easy way to get a water well operating effectively was to attach the well to a playground, what's it called, merry-go-round.
Right.
And then have the children play on the merry-go-round. And so the children, by playing on the merry-go-round, would pump the water up from the water table and give clean water to the village. So this is just thought to be, wow, a slam dunk idea. What a brilliant idea. You can just harness the play of children that they want to do anyway and get clean water for the village. This is called the play pump. And so, you know, the NGO started building play pumps and installing them in villages, in some villages in Africa. And then someone later went back to see how these are operating, and they found kind of a sad picture of some pretty old women kind of trudging all day, turning around the merry-go-round to pump the water. Turned out just to be a very inefficient pump that made the labor of the old women responsible for pumping even worse. Because it just didn't turn out to work, that the children just didn't play enough or didn't want to play enough to make the pump work. So it was sort of a whole cascade of problems that went wrong there, that you didn't consult people, that they were not involved in their own project, that they were not involved in deciding for themselves how much time the children had to play, how much time the old women had to, you know, what kind of pumps the old women would have preferred to. Yeah, you just, everything went wrong there because of the failure to respect participation and agency.
Right. No, I think that's a good and unfortunately all too common example. But the other, what's the example you also give about the soccer balls?
That's like, another one in the same category.
Maybe tell that one.
Another brilliant idea was to have soccer balls sort of be like mini generators to store kinetic energy when they were kicked around. They would produce kinetic energy that would be stored in the soccer balls. And then at night you could plug the soccer balls into a lamp, and then families would have reading lamps at night by which they could read, and they would have light. So what could possibly go wrong? Well, again, the problem with bright ideas is not that they're dumb ideas. It's that the way the ideas were implemented and designed in the first place was they did not consult enough with the people involved. So the problem here is that, with soccer balls, kids in sub-Saharan Africa where this was piloted loved to play soccer all day. And they played soccer so much that it turns out that if you kick a piece of metal machinery a lot, it tends to break. So when kids are playing sort of soccer all day along with these balls, instead of storing kinetic energy, they just break. And so, it just went wrong from the beginning there. And, President Obama was on a trip to Africa and, was photographed playing with these soccer balls and saying what a great idea. And, there's also sort of this, again, there's this sort of trivializing of a problem, which is itself sort of disrespectful of the people involved. So would we try to solve energy problems in the West with soccer balls?
Exactly.
We're sort of aware that energy problems in the West, require power plants, not soccer balls.
Right.
It takes a sort of radical disrespect that you think that kind of obviousness does not apply to somewhere else. That it's fundamental to solve, electricity. You fundamentally need to solve the power plant problem and not the soccer ball problem. So you go wrong so many ways when you have the sort of top-down, paternalistic, coercive, unequal, non-participatory model of development.
I think a couple of things you highlight there, like one is, I think the way you said it is like you trivialize problems. And so what happens is the developing world becomes a lab for experiments, and for like a young engineer who wants to do this cool thing. Okay. But as you said, we don't solve that problem of power and electricity with soccer balls. We do a water power, coal, nuclear power. I mean, we're thinking power plants. And I do think that is a kind of a common problem where let's try like these new innovative things, but they're not taking the seriousness of the problem in front of them. I think the other thing is, and this is actually how we explain this in this way in the film Poverty Inc. I use the example of the social fact of Emil Durkheim's idea, like these are these institutions, beliefs, ideas that kind of shape the way you see the world. And that the social fact or model, the dominant model of development, is what you've just described. It has these errors in it. And so one of the things that I've noticed, and feel you can disagree with me on this, but one of the things I've noticed is that a lot of the innovation, they're not bad ideas, but they all operate, almost all of them operate within the broken dominant model assumptions of the social fact. And so it's not like the innovation isn't a new way of solving a problem. It's like, okay, we have this broken model and let's innovate inside the model. Well, okay, you're just going to sometimes become more efficiently harmful. Or that seems to be a problem the way I see it. How do you react to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, the sort of problem is there's really no system that's sort of giving feedback on what the outside aid worker or expert is doing. So you don't have sort of a market test of whether their idea makes sense. They just have the ability to go in and do their own project in the village, you know, even though they haven't subjected it to any kind of market test. And, you know, that's something that no innovator in the U.S. or the U.K. would ever conceive of, you know, that you're just so. One problem with NGOs I noticed is everyone always wants to start their own new NGO.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
You know, and I don't want to kind of downplay the kind of genuine sincerity mm-hmm. and commitment to doing good that people who start NGOs have. And there are very good and successful NGOs.
Mm-hmm.
But when you sort of come in saying, you know, I want to start my own NGO, and, you know, frankly, people suspect it is sort of a vanity project to start my own NGO. You know, well, does the market work like that in the U.S.? You know, does every new worker in the economy start their own business? Do they insist on starting their own business as a condition for them entering the economy? Obviously not, because, you know, they would have to pass the severe market test of starting a business. But if NGOs don't have to pass that market test, then yes, they can get away with every new NGO founder starts their own enterprise. So you got the socket, I think, was the soccer ball that was supposed to power villages, and you get the play pump. Because there's a sort of, and, you know, if someone was being very unkind, which I don't really want to be, but I know there was this phrase that Frederick Douglass used after the Civil War when he was complaining about nobodies from the North coming down to the South and offering themselves as saviors to freed ex-slaves. And Douglass has this phrase, you know, these are like preachers without pulpits, they're professors without chairs. They sort of, you know, failed in the North, and then they came and, you know, found a new opportunity to do good for themselves and allegedly for others in the South. So why was Frederick Douglass being so mean? Because, you know, he really did see this sort of radical disrespect of African Americans as agents in their own lives to you know, foster their own recovery from slavery, and to be led by, you know, people from their own community. That's what offended Frederick Douglass. So I don't want to tag that to any people operating today necessarily, but that's kind of the concern, that somebody can be sort of a failure in one society and then can go to a much poorer society that has no right to resist them and kind of reinvent themselves as a savior. And, you know, that's usually not a good thing.
Indeed, it's not. I think there's that problem. And I think there's just the other problem, which we've talked about, to restate, is that when you have a technocratic mindset, it leads you to make these errors and you're kind of blind to them. You have that error. I want to go into markets, and you have in The White Man's Burden, you talk about searchers versus planners. I think that's the distinction you make, searchers, planners. But before going there, I want to go back to something you said that I think is really important about the deeper point of Hayek and the idea of spontaneous order, et cetera. Now, I have maybe we disagree a little bit, but generally I'm with you on this. I think that here's how I kind of think about it. I need a better term that I'll use. But okay, so I would say that I think that's what he's saying, the deeper point, is very, very important. There is spontaneous order that emerges. And I like Burke. Obviously, the moral imagination is a Burkean line. So I like kind of a Burkean view that these things happen over trial and error over time. And I think that's what you're saying too. But I think this Burkean element that you said, there's these principles that no social planner or engineer could develop. They kind of happen over time. And I think that thinking of it in that there are principles and visions of life that often come from religious principles, like deep religious principles, like the linearity of time, right? As Nietzsche points out, I mean, this is a Jewish idea that penetrates the West. This idea then of progress, the dignity of manual labor. So for example, you know, the Talmud talks about the dignity of manual labor. St. Benedict talks about the dignity, but the Greeks and the Romans didn't really see manual labor they thought as servile and kind of beneath the upper classes. I think these ideas also are principles that begin to penetrate as part of this trial and error that create the conditions for spontaneous order. So this is what I wanted. So I'm going on a little long here, but I want you to maybe react to this. I think we talked about this before. Mariana Mazzucato, who's a very famous European economist, Italian, well-known, very influential today. You know, she's written a number of things, The Value of Everything and The Entrepreneurial State. And one of the arguments she makes, are you familiar with her work? Have you read it yet? Okay. It would be good for you to read it, I think, because she's like very influential. So she has this argument that she takes the iPhone and she holds it up and she says, you know, you think this iPhone came from the free market, but actually all of the elements in the phone, the smartphone that make the phone smart, actually were developed by DARPA and the US military. And so the idea that it's made simply by the free market is an error. So I have, then she has another book called Moonshot, where she says, we've got, you know, people to the moon. And if we can get people to the moon, we should be able to end cancer, end obesity, you know, all these other great things, climate change, whatever. And so she thinks we need these state-led, state kind of capitalism projects to accomplish these great things. So that's her argument. And I have three main critiques. So my first positive response is, and feel free to critique or disagree with anything I say. My first positive response is, okay, it's actually a good kind of, not just the word I'm looking for, corrective to say a radical free marketer who thinks the iPhone just kind of emerged out of nothing with free markets. Yes, it's true. The state developed these things, but she's missing the fact that it's not the state didn't simply develop the iPhone. The technologies that exist don't equal the iPhone. And in fact, it was entrepreneurs and the market that used these technologies to create something new. So I think she kind of, just like she criticizes the free marketer for neglecting government role, she also neglects the market role. That's my first. Maybe I'm wrong.
Can I jump in on that one?
Yeah, sure.
I think while you're talking, I was thinking of the example of penicillin. Mm-hmm. So penicillin kind of famously happened because I think it was Alexander Fleming sort of accidentally left some laboratory dishes overnight and mold grew on them. And then he noticed the mold was killing the bacteria. So that would be another example of, you know, something that didn't happen because of the market, right? It was an accident of someone who was not intending to be an entrepreneur or do good or supply good to the market. But then that's sort of part of the beauty of the market is it takes all the completely accidental discoveries that may have happened for some totally non-market reason. She's totally right. You know, there are parts of the internet were invented in the Defense Department. But then these sort of accidental discoveries, how do they kind of explode and be brought to scale and, you know, do a lot of good? It's then that they enter the marketplace, that someone in the marketplace notices that, you know, this can be a powerful thing that will appeal to a lot of consumers. And even penicillin, which we think of as, you know, like a public good or something, you know, itself became the basis of a tremendous market operation of making and selling, you know, very cheap antibiotics that had a huge effect on infant mortality all over the world. So something that seemed at first to emerge in a non-market setting, you know, that's just, you know, ideas can come from anywhere. They can come from literature professors. They can come from government officials. They can come from the Defense Department. It doesn't really matter where they come from. The point is, it's the market that sort of tests them as to whether they benefit human well-being. Does the market test them? You know, can they be produced at a cost that consumers want to buy and think this is something desirable that they buy? That's sort of the key to the whole story, I think.
I think that's right. I think the penicillin is a great example of that because that's where the spontaneous order element, right? Because you have the institutions of justice, private property and rule of law and all of these things, markets can then work and distribute. And I think you give this example, I think it's at the beginning of White Man's Burden, right? Where you like talk about getting mosquito nets delivered versus delivering, what is it, Harry Potter novels.
Right.
Isn't that, I mean, that's kind of, I want to go back to Mazzucato because I think there's some deeper points. Let's do that though. I mean, I think your example is a really good one. Like, how do things get delivered? And I think the comparison, could you talk about that comparison you made between Harry Potter novel and I think it was Mosquito Nets, right?
Yeah. So, you know, both are sort of are really private goods. They're not public goods in the sense that they, you know, are non-excludable and non-rival, meaning that public good is something that doesn't pay the entrepreneur to produce because he can't exclude users from using it. Something like a, you know, like a lighthouse being a classic example. But something like mosquito nets, they are a private good because they give the user immediate benefit of being protected from mosquitoes that carry malaria. And the user can go out into the market and buy a mosquito net. But that's not how the aid community distributed mosquito nets. They decided to do a mass distribution of free mosquito nets. And that may have actually had some success at lowering malaria, as I was admitting when I saw the data later on. This really worked better than I thought. But still, there's this problem that when the aid community came along, they recognized there was this huge problem that there had not been enough mosquito nets. Why was that? Why was it that there were not enough mosquito nets? It's because the lack of a market operating to make this possible and the reliance on the previous generations of aid providers had not succeeded in getting enough mosquito nets. Whereas, you know, there was never like a shortage of Harry Potter novels, you know, because as my kids and all the other kids demanded more, and I myself, for that matter, demanded more Harry Potter novels, the publisher just, you know, churned the printing, just kept the printing presses running to go faster and faster, produce more Harry Potter novels. You know, the market solves these problems with very little effort. And when you kind of neglect to use the market channel to benefit human well-being, you're kind of losing out on that enormous success that has actually happened with markets and leaving yourself stuck with us kind of lame aid bureaucrats that do not have a great track record of delivering a lot of good. So yeah, I think there's this phrase that I like that I used in the book that the rich have markets, the poor have bureaucrats.
That's unfortunately truer than it should be. I want to go back to markets because I want to talk about some of the, just a couple quick questions on that. But let me go back into this Mazzucato point because I think it relates to the kind of the debate between Gunnar Myrdal and Friedrich Hayek. So my other critique of Mazzucato's argument is first the market one. The second one is, well, there are opportunity costs. And so all the government funding into the moon landing meant that the government wasn't doing funding in other things. So you're still picking certain things and the government might make errors. That's my second. My third problem.
Yeah, the second problem, I like the line from Margaret Thatcher that sooner or later you run out of other people's money.
Yes, exactly.
So when you're doing your moonshots, you're taxing someone else to provide the resources for the moonshots. If you do endless moonshots, you know, without limit, you know, you're taxing people more and more and more and more to finance the moonshots and you know, not giving those people an incentive to earn income for themselves. So you're going to run out of other people's money.
Mm-hmm. And you might make an error. And that's my third one, is we've got a lot of moonshots. I would say the war on poverty is a moonshot that ended up destroying the Black family, among other things. There's a lot to talk about there. But I mean, we know that the war on poverty has had a lot of negative effects on the family and punishes marriage for lowest income earners. We've seen, for example, the standard American diet, right, which subsidized farmers and created a lot of problems with obesity and diabetes. I mean, there's a lot of things that the government has tried to do that ended up actually not working. And so the kind of cherry picking of we got to the moon, yes, but we also like made Americans fat and sick by subsidizing. So I think we need to debate that. That's my third critique. And then my fourth critique, which I think is the most important and the deepest one and also related to your point, is I say it this way, and I need a better term. Maybe you can help me, Bill, with this, because I use the term loosely of embedded economics, but that's actually like Carl Polanyi uses that term, I think, to mean something different. So I have to figure out. But what I mean by embedded is this. Yes, you're right. The smartphone came from government military things, but why did we have a big military? Oh, well, because we were very powerful. We won World War II. Why did we do that? Well, we had good tax base. Why do we have a tax base? Well, we have a commercial society and a constitutional republic. Well, wait, why do we have that? Oh, well, because, we had the Mayflower Compact. Oh, well, why do we have that? Well, because we had the Magna Carta. And why do we have that? Well, in the medieval period, there was a commercial revolution from about 1800 to 1400, where you had the development of limited liability corporations and, this and banking. Yeah, yeah. And why do we have that? Well, because we think property is really important. Why? Because the Romans thought it important, and because Exodus 22 says, you shall not steal. And we have a justice system grounded in Leviticus 19:16 that says you should be impartial in your justice, which manifests in rule of law and in constitutional republics. And so the point is, yes, the iPhone came from Leviticus 19:16. At some point, we're so deeply embedded that it seems like this is a reflective, and I'm not trying to pick on Mariana Mazzucato, but I mean, it's like this idea to me, and feel free to critique it. It's like, the idea that somehow the military produced this is like everything is so deeply complex. And this goes back to your point of, we don't even know why we're wealthy. I have this line, I kind of joke. It's like me coming from the United States to say Ghana or Uganda or Kenya and saying, I'm going to help you develop your economy. I don't mean that nobody knows anything. Don't get me wrong. I don't want to overstate it. But it's a little bit parallel at this point to me saying, I have my light switches turn on. So I'm going to come over to your house and wire your electricity because I know how to turn on a light switch. I just think that generally development people, and I'm not saying I'm better, I'm just saying generally the lack of knowledge over what it takes to get this spontaneous order, we take it so much for granted that we think we can just go engineer other people. What do you think?
Yeah, totally. I mean, one of my friends whose economics I admire a lot, Land Pritchett, gave the example of, because I can drive a car doesn't mean I know how to invent or make a car. I can drive the car, but I can't make the car. And the hubris that I have that because I'm, happily driving along the highway in a rich society and, the car is obeying my commands. But I think, I can then take my knowledge to another society and start making cars in another society. That's kind of the hubris that you're getting at, I think.
Yeah. Cars and highways and gas stations, everything.
Right, exactly.
So that's kind of, I think that's why I think that Hayek point, like it was, you said it and you went to the deeper problem, like that the trial and error, the intense social, philosophical, theological, economic, and political complexity that we live in, that we just take for granted is I have this line here. I say ignoring the invisible. I said, if you spent all of your time thinking about how complex the situation is in, you'd go crazy. Right. So you don't want to do that. But if you forget it always, then I think you end up falling prey to the hubris of the technocrat.
Yes. Agreed.
So we've talked about a lot of the foreign aid and moving on. One other question about markets, and I do have some other questions that I want to get to. Well, okay, let me come back to markets in a second because let me finish the aid thing. So how do we think about this? Now, I'm obviously sympathetic to your argument. Like I like your books and I'm like, when I read them, I was like, yes. But, a couple of things people would say is, and you and Jeffrey Sachs got in big debates over this. I mean, Jeffrey Sachs is like, I have been doing this for years. I've seen these things. And people would say, we've really made, Bill Gates and all, there's this strong idea that aid in healthcare, education, and infrastructure is very important. It's really helped everybody. I'm skeptical of this because I think if you're highly educated, really healthy, and have good roads, but you don't have private property and rights, you're going to either despair, join the political or criminal class, or migrate. So, but what would you say to the levels of critique is one is like, okay, don't you think there's absolutely a need in healthcare, education, and infrastructure? And then two, okay, yeah, aid maybe has some negative effects, but people are dying. People are starving. Without aid, everything's going to fall apart. What do you do? How do you think about this? How do you respond to those things?
Yeah. So, I mean, all economists since virtually all economists since Adam Smith have agreed that markets don't solve everything.
Exactly.
There are goods that markets do not provide well. Your health or educational example. So let's take health. So suppose you're talking about a contagious disease, where if you give someone some medicine to cure the disease, they won't pass it on to somebody else. Or you give them a vaccine to prevent them getting that disease in the first place, they won't pass it on to someone else. That's a good that the market doesn't do well because the market doesn't take into account how my consumption of that good affects someone else. Mm-hmm. And so there's a case that is, you know, widely accepted that that is something you need to subsidize. Maybe you need to subsidize the private providers. Maybe the government needs to provide that good. You know, something, there needs to be some intervention to make, to solve that problem. That's fine. And I think most economists would agree on that. So, and then I think the deeper critique is, let's take first the, what I think is probably the best single one sentence argument about aid. People like Jeff Sachs basically said, ending poverty is much easier than it appears. You know, you just need these aid programs to end poverty. And then I think the one sentence instinct that the economist always has to have is, you know, if it's so easy to fix, why wasn't it fixed already? You know, there were previous generations that also thought it was easy, that had the means to do so. Why didn't they fix it already? But, you know, that argument could be turned back on the kind of pro-market development economists to say, well, if markets are the answer, why didn't they fix the problem already? Why are there still poor countries if markets are the answer? And there, I think it is really important to acknowledge the kind of complexity that you were talking about, that markets don't kind of invent themselves. They need to be, your word embedded, I sort of don't like that word that much because it's very jargony, but it's pretty much accurate. Markets are embedded in a whole set of societal norms and institutions that make them possible. And that, you know, without the sort of elementary respect for property rights, for, you know, being able to operate without widespread crime, all those things, or many, many other conditions like that that we have for markets to work, that sort of is what is necessary for markets to work. So it is a more complex fix. Mm-hmm. You don't offer the kind of easy fix that the aid advocates do, which will, you know, easy people who offer easy solutions usually win the intellectual argument, because nobody wants to be told, you know, this is very complex. It's going to take a lot of uncertain effort and very hard effort to get it right. You know, that's not a very popular message ever. So that's why the easy answers tend to win. But, you know, there is a concern, like you said, well, are you just saying do nothing and let these poor people in desperate circumstances just starve and suffer and have all those bad things happen to them? I think nobody wants to see bad things happen to other people. I think there's a basic amount of compassion that all human beings have towards other human beings that I think aid does tap into, and that is a good thing. But, you know, the compassion should be tapped into in a way that is not, at the very least, do no harm. Now, do no harm is the first principle of, medicine. It should be the first principle of aid. You know, is your kind of well-meaning compassion, is there some possibility that it might actually do some harm? So at the very least, you want to ask yourself that very hard question and make sure it's doing no harm. Make sure you pass that test. Then after that, if you're not making things worse, you know, are there modest things that could make things work better? And that's fine. You know, I mean, I do like NGOs who go out there and mm-hmm. where there's shortages of essential medicines or even providing cheap foods in famine situations. You know, that's great. There's nothing wrong with that. Mm-hmm. But if you're trying to, so in those kind of settings, you're not really trying to socially engineer the development of a whole society. You're just trying to meet a desperate need because there's an emergency and you're meeting a desperate need, and that's great. And I salute the altruism and hard work of people who do that. That's great. If your aim is really to launch the fundamental development of a whole society, that's where you really need to have some caution that you're not doing more harm than good when you have that kind of delusion and hubris that you can reinvent, that you can socially engineer someone else's society.
No, yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think that's, you know, if we, like I was saying, like, Eight in emergencies, you need eight. I think one of the problems we've used like an emergency model as the response, as the, or like our emergency situation as the model for development. Like that we think of, this is maybe a silly example, but I say like, you know, the first time you go to the developing world and you see dirt floors and everything, you think it's an emergency for you, right? It's not an emergency for the people who live there. It's a chronic problem. And so, you know, I think that in, and so I think this, tension between you want to care and you want to help versus, and I think versus, okay, let me do no harm. And I think that's where like consent and participation and how I say like they should be the protagonist of their story of development helps
and
avoid
that. And I think that's where dignity comes in also. The way that the violation of dignity that happens when, you know, when if I as an aid worker parachute in and tell them, you know, I figured out their problem and I'm going to solve it for them. Now, that's kind of disrespectful of their own knowledge of their own problem and their own efforts that they've already made to deal with that problem. And, you know, there's some violation of dignity that is happening there that is really, really, really important. I think I wish we did pay a lot more attention and aid to the fundamental human dignity like that.
Yeah, I agree. So let me, a couple of things. I know I don't want to take too much more of your time, but one thing I would like to, I want to ask you first about markets and then just maybe a little bit on your new book again. So I guess that's one of the questions like is what can be done? And one of the things I say, and again, feel free to critique or define this. Although I also want to ask you, like, we've got to get a better word than embedded. I always say embodied, embedded persons. And I have a whole explanation of what I mean by an embedded person in that of complexity. And that I like, but I think something like the embedded doesn't, with economics, you're saying, Polanyi and everything. So if you have a better word, let's find it. So I think about markets. So what I'll often say is what poor people need generally is they're not poor because they lack stuff. Yeah. They're often poor because they're excluded from institutions of justice, things that we take for granted, like clear title to land, who owns the land you live on, ability to get their court case heard, ability to register their business in the formal economy, you know, ability to have exchange without undue burden or price fixing and everything. Kind of the example you give from the Northern Ohio / Uganda example. But when people have those institutions of justice, they tend to be able to create prosperity in their own families and communities. And one of my critiques of the aid model, again, not of all aid, I'm not going to make, sometimes aid is necessary. But that those, the way, and this is Peter Bauer really, but also you, but I mean, like Peter Bauer is like where I first saw this, like by politicizing development, the foreign aid model, the development model, and in the, including the NGOs, actually create negative incentive for those governments to build those institutions for their people.
Yeah.
Do you think that's right? How would you respond to that?
Yeah, well, I think it's even a little bit worse that aid is often influenced by political considerations in the donor country. So one example of this is, you know, after 9/11, a lot of aid decisions were heavily influenced by who were the U.S.'s allies in the war on terror. So going back to Uganda, Museveni, the president of Uganda, was very much an ally of the U.S. in the war on terror. He was providing Ugandan troops to fight al-Shabaab in Somalia and doing other things to help the U.S. on the war on terror. He got tons of aid, you know, as a reward for doing that. And, you know, that was the setting in which this Mubende Uganda story happened, in which rights are violated. So it's not an accident that a bad guy is in power in Uganda when the bad guy is supported, heavily supported by lots and lots of U.S. aid as a reward for something else that is not related to development. And the same thing was happening in the Cold War, notoriously, that allies in the Cold War were getting a lot, like Mobutu and Zaire were getting lots of aid. And so there's a way in which aid was often kind of unintentionally selecting on bad guys and supporting bad guys and perpetuating in power bad guys to last longer in power. And so it's, and this is something Angus Deaton also makes a big deal about in The Great Escape. So it could actually be even making things worse. It's not simply zero effectiveness, but it could be having negative effectiveness if it's perpetuating the conditions that are creating poverty and making them last even longer than they would have without aid.
What then can be done? I mean, you're kind of arguing that you need markets, but markets, as you, as we've talked about, aren't just like, they don't just show up, but they rely on these kind of government, good governance, political institutions, private property, access to justice in the courts, you know. But one of the critiques would be, well, you're just, A, that doesn't happen, and B, capitalism just hurts the poor, it exploits the poor, it takes advantage of the poor, it destroys culture, it gives you lots of junk, and this whole capitalist model really is exploitative, and it has promises, but the argument would be maybe, look, Hayek won the argument with Keynes, et cetera, and Dahl. The whole world became radically free market. And I don't think that's actually true. In the data, it's pretty clear it's not, but that's the argument. That the whole world, we tried markets and markets have failed. And now we need industrial policy. We need, people in Ohio are losing their jobs because of globalization. Africa's been left behind. How do you respond to that? I mean, the enthusiasm with markets after the Cold War were great, but it didn't pan out like we hoped. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, obviously I'm encountering that idea a lot. People refer to the market case as being like something they call neoliberalism, which is a word that I really hate.
But well, yeah, because it's hard to know what it means.
It's hard to know what it means, except it's something people don't like.
Right.
But usually they mean, you know, pro-market reforms by neoliberalism. And so first of all, there was an enormous move toward, away from the most extreme restrictions on markets towards a liberalization of those extreme restrictions, stopping a long way short of any kind of perfect free market society, as both the friends of free markets would say, it's not as much as we wanted, and the enemies of free markets would say, you know, we thought it was too much, but it's stopping well short of what anyone would call a free market society, because there's still tons of restrictions on markets after all that. But what did happen was, for example, you know, countries in Latin America, it used to be very prevalent to have inflation rates, you know, well above 40% or maybe even 100%. Inflation rates above 20 or 40% used to apply to about 80% of all Latin American countries. Now there's very few countries in Latin America that have high inflation, Venezuela and Argentina and almost nobody else. In Africa, there were very high restrictions on foreign exchange that killed off imports. Those extreme restrictions largely disappeared after the end of the Cold War and pro-market reforms came in, usually often led by homegrown reformers, by the way, not imposed by outsiders. What else has happened? India moved away from the Raj state to being a much more pro-trade, pro-market society. India had a big takeoff. What happened in China? China moved from central planning to international trade, to being the most powerful participant in international trade. Still a long way short of free markets, and definitely way short of a liberal society. No, nothing like a liberal society, but just kind of a partial move away from extreme restrictions towards markets. You know, this led to the greatest reduction in poverty in human history. All of these events that I just described led to the greatest reduction in poverty in human history. So that's the way in which, yes, markets did work. And no, there was not the end of neoliberalism, as people are often trying to celebrate. Those moves were never reversed. They have not been reversed. Those moves were permanent away from those extreme restrictions. So now we're sort of in the in-between world where the extreme restrictions have gone and they're still a long way short of free markets. And so now there's this sort of muddled debate, and there is this rise of populism on the right that is sort of disavowing trade and markets and seeing trade as a zero-sum game rather than a positive-sum game. And the left is turning even more against trade as before. So, you know, there is this sort of alarming moment at the moment that it seems like kind of the intuition behind markets and trade as kind of a way to for us to exchange with each other, to make each other better off, that view of the world is maybe in danger now, and that worries me a little bit. So far, those forces have not been strong enough to reverse all of the progress that was made after the end of the Cold War.
What do you think about the argument? I mean, I know your specialty is in development, but what do you think about the argument in the United States about, you're an economist, I'm not an economist. So we had trade with China. China case is super important that you make the qualifications you did. I mean, China in many ways adopted the technical aspects of a market and gave special permission to groups of people and were able to flourish and reduce poverty. But that doesn't mean they actually took all the institutions of justice that give freedom and human dignity, right? They're an oppressive state. So, but what about this idea? Like, well, you know, we did globalization and the idea was everyone's going to be better off and there's going to be some who take a hit for the team, but we can, the fact that everybody's better off, we can redistribute the gains. But the facts are a lot of people, even in certain, let's say, industrial towns, have suffered not just for 6 months, but intergenerationally. And now we have these like broken towns. And this is kind of part of the populist right concern. How do we think about that? What are the problems there? And then how, and I think in some ways, we have said, okay, you're going to take a hit for the team, but we didn't actually address the problems. And that the way we've tried to solve some of the structural shifts that come from globalization have actually not helped the poor or the working class. How do you respond to that? How do we think about those problems?
Yeah. So first you could, I could kind of have a knee jerk response. Well, actually markets did help the poor and poverty rates went down a lot in every country, including the US over a long period of time, embracing markets, poverty rates in the US went way down. However, I very much take what you're saying. And I'm also very mindful that the pro-trade, pro-market economists should not themselves not suffer from arrogance and hubris and telling other people what they should want. So I should not go into some, my family is from West Virginia and I grew up in Ohio in the farm country, but close to, not far from the Rust Belt. You know, I'm the last one to go in and a small town in Ohio that's lost its factory to Chinese competition and say, what you guys should want is more trade with China because that's good for the U.S. as a whole. And, you know, if you only knew your own interests better, then you could, move to some export industry in some other city and, abandon this derelict town that's been destroyed by Chinese competition. You know, it would be very arrogant and presumptuous for me to tell them what they should want. So I very much caution against that also. I think there's a couple of things here that, first of all of this should be subject to some kind of democratic process where the grievances of those who did lose their livelihood to import competition get to be heard and get to be addressed. Mm-hmm. And no economist of either the free market or the anti-market persuasion should be in charge of all of this. It should be some democratic process that hears the voices of those who have lost. That is a big thing about markets. Markets cause a lot of dislocation and cause a lot of dislocation. And there are people who lose out big time to these dislocations. And then you want to ask, what do you want to have happen? Do you want to have the dislocations end at all costs? Or do you want to find some other way of trying to help the losers from those dislocations? And remember, the dislocations are not only happening because of Chinese competition. You know, they're also happening because of technological innovations and new products replacing old products. You know, so the laptop computer came along and destroyed the typewriter. You know, so the workers at the typewriter factory lost their jobs and the typewriter factory closed and maybe there's no other factory in that town and that town goes downhill. There's no good answer to that except to think of some way of helping those who have been hurt, which we also don't have good answers for. I think the one thing we definitely, as economists, either pro-market or anti-market, don't want to do is say that, is think that we have the right to tell other people what they should want, that you should not care about this because we think this is going to be better off for everybody in the long run. We don't have the right to say that.
I mean, it's a difficult problem. And I think starting in that way, in a sense, with that lack of technocratic hubris or whatever, which has been a theme, is a good start. And then because you're dealing with complex things, right? There are trade-offs. Yes. There are real trade-offs that go along. And in one sense, the economy is clearly not a zero-sum game. I think that's a clear error. But that doesn't mean because there's not a zero-sum game that there aren't actual real trade-offs that take place. And they take, prudence and a thought and participation to come up with the best solution for them. So I think that's That's a good way of, I think, framing at least how to think about the problem, if not giving us an answer. Maybe we can end then on your newest book, which I think relates to this whole thematic we've talked about a little bit. Your newest book is really kind of going to look at, what was the working title? Did you say? I forget.
So the working title is In the Name of Development.
In the Name of Development. Okay. Yeah.
Or In the Name of Progress. I'm not sure yet on whether I use progress or development. And I think progress is probably better. In the Name of Progress. Mm-hmm. The Moral Debate Over the West, Development of the Rest. Goes back to Adam Smith and even to John Winthrop in Massachusetts, and uses lots of historical examples to talk about how economists have discussed the moral rules that progress has to obey in order for progress to be beneficial. And those moral rules are very much oriented on consent instead of coercion, self-determination instead of paternalism, moral equality instead of hierarchy. And examples I have in mind are like attempts to develop the Native Americans in the U.S., the arguments over the supposedly benevolent, the idea of benevolent slavery that happened through several generations over the abolition of the slave trade and then the abolition of slavery, the moral crusade against King Leopold's Congo, conquest and colonization of the Philippines, which was the moment the U.S. moved away from being a non-interventionist, non-imperial state to being a colonial state, and sort of became the moment at which the U.S. moved away from kind of the Washington, John Quincy Adams tradition of not going abroad in search of monsters to destroy, in this phrase of John Quincy Adams, and became an interventionist state that sets up kind of the very interventionist foreign policy of the U.S. today, which I think is also an anti-liberal policy that needs to be debated. And then, you know, going to the modern period kind of development, the role that development ideas played in the Vietnam War, the modern reincarnation of that in the war in Afghanistan. So just going, you know, one example after another on how material progress is never enough to justify your claim that you're operating for the benefit of someone else. You always need to have a moral, be guided by a moral guideline that you're respecting someone else's right to consent to their own progress.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm looking forward to reading that. I think it's interesting. I mean, as you know, we're working on a project now in poverty in the United States, where you see a lot of the same social engineering ideas, you know, like transportation, going through communities and breaking them apart, or public housing, where tenements are put down and then people are put into public housing. And all the problems that came from that, because it was a kind of a sense of, oh, we know how to do best for you. You and I talked briefly about the work of James Scott, which I think is so interesting. Like, you know, his book, Seeing Like a State. And I love the example he gives in the beginning of the book of forestry, where he says, like, German foresters, I think you know this, but for listeners, German foresters wanted to be very hyper-productive with their forestry. So they essentially cleared out the forest, planted all these trees in straight lines, and their productivity shot up. But after a time, all of a sudden, things went wrong and there was forest death. And they discovered that they had destroyed the ecosystem, the complex ecosystem of flora, fauna, birds, animals, ants, etc., that had enabled the forest to be so productive. And they ended up in realizing that because they had seen like a state, they'd reduced everything to one problem or two problems. They'd ended up creating all this harm. I think there's like overlap with that in the name of progress.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a great example. Yeah.
I think Scott's, and like Brasilia is another example he gives from several books. He uses other people's books on Brasilia, but you know, I've been to Brasilia and I filmed there, and it's so interesting. I thought they only forgot one thing when they built Brasilia, that people were going to live there.
Right.
I mean, right. It's unbelievable, you know,
Cities are a great example of spontaneous order. Nobody planned them. I mean, there is some planning, obviously, of roads and sewers and water lines and electricity lines and telephone lines, but in the old days, that planning is kind of, to use your favorite word, embedded in a spontaneous order in which people, you know, freely decide what neighborhood is going to be like the character of neighborhoods is going to be freely decided by people's spontaneous moving and building decisions.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. It's interesting. And I think there's like these overlaps of neighborhoods and things. So maybe that's, I think we talked about Jane Jacobs too, right? I mean, this is.
I did a project with a couple of co-authors at NYU that we looked at one block near NYU in New York City and traced a 400-year history of that block. And it was just sort of amazing how that block just shifted around radically in ways that nobody had predicted or planned. It went from being farmland to being kind of luxury housing on the outskirts of the small New York City. Then it became kind of a bustling hotel area. And for a while, it was a red light district, really a seedy neighborhood, a red light district. Then garment factories came in and took it over. Then it became a slum. Then it became art galleries. Then it became luxury retail and luxury apartments, which is pretty much what it is today. There's just this unplanned evolution that is not always in the right direction of what someone thinks is good for, is a good outcome. But, you know, in the long run, it leads to kind of flourishing cities.
Can I link to that paper?
Yeah.
Okay. I'll give you a link to that.
Yeah.
Okay. No, that's good. I think this is part of the human element, and maybe we can just end here on this topic, which is part of your book before we started, I think this point is really important. Like, material progress is never enough. It seems to be a dominant problem of our age across the right, across the left, free marketers, anti-marketers, that we're very materialist. And I mean, like, philosophically materialist, even people who aren't philosophical materialists, like, I'm not one, right? But there's a certain kind of, it's the spirit of the age is we think in efficiency and materialism and utilitarian ways. And there's a lot of good that comes from that, but it's only one aspect of what a human life looks like. And so maybe you could end just by that, talking a little bit about that tension that is, I think, at the heart of your newest book.
Yeah, it's very much the tension that man is not just, like you said, man is just not simply a material being. There is a demand for agency. There is a demand for dignity. There's a demand for these non-material goods, for self-determination, for the sense of deep moral equality that I get to follow the same rules that everyone else does. I get to benefit from the same rules that everyone else does. And it's sort of radical denial of human dignity to be coercing someone to say, I know what is best for you and I'm going to force you to take it. And I have the right to do this because I belong to a superior group of developed countries and you are an inferior group of less developing countries. That kind of deep inequality, I think, is a fundamental affront to human dignity that simply cannot be tolerated. And if that demand for dignity is not met in a liberal way, it's going to be met in a very illiberal way. And that's kind of the big danger of our time, I think. I mean, Putin is very much aware of the need for dignity of the Russian people, but he's meeting it in a savagely illiberal way of, you know, Russian dignity is going to be enhanced by a zero-sum game of conquering Ukraine and conquering who knows what else after that. And it's the critical moral debate of our time is there needs to be a liberal way to offer people what they want in terms of dignity and self-determination. Because if that's not an offer, then the illiberal guys are going to win.
Okay, good. Well, thank you very much for your time. It's really, as I said, a delight and an honor to talk to you. The books I mentioned I'll put in the show notes are The Elusive Quest for Growth, The Tyranny of Experts, The White Man's Burden, and then the forthcoming book, which is tentatively titled In the Name of Progress. And I'll put links to that paper if you get me that paper and some of the other books that we talked about on the show notes. Bill, thank you very much for joining the Moral Imagination Podcast.
Thank you, Michael. It was a great pleasure chatting with you.